from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. It happened 50 years ago this summer.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech stands alongside the Gettysburg Address in American Oratory. But the story behind the speech is less well known. We'll get that story from those who were there and consider where the dream stands today, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. 50 years ago this summer, Martin Luther King stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington and gave a speech that would, in Lincoln's words, be long remembered.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah.
We know the speech, of course, but we don't know as much about the story behind it. And in this hour of Forum, we're joined by three people who knew Martin Luther King well, were there that day, and so we will consider with them where the dream now stands 50 years after Dr. King spoke those words and where we go from here, which was, of course, also the title of one of Dr. King's final speeches. Joining us for our conversation, Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. His latest book is the memoir Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Claiborne Carson, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us, too, is Dorothy Cotton. She's a civil rights leader and former education director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. She is also the author of If Your Back's Not Bent, The Role of the Citizenship Education Program in the Civil Rights Movement. Dorothy Cotton, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone this morning is Clarence Jones, scholar in residence and writer in residence at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. He was a lawyer and political advisor, helped draft the I Have a Dream speech. He's also the co-author of Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. Clarence Jones, thanks for being with us as well.
Yes, sir. Hi. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you. Thanks for being part of our program. I should also note that Claiborne Carson and Dorothy Cotton will be part of a panel which will be held tonight at 7:30 at the Hyatt Regency in Burlingame. It's being held by the California Council for Social Studies, where they'll also focus on the questions we're going to consider this morning as well. So I want to go back to that summer day in 1963. You were 19 years old at the time, Claiborne Carson. What stands out to you as you think about that day 50 years ago?
I think the major thing is that for me, I didn't know that this was going to be the historic event that it became. For me, it was the largest demonstration I'd ever been because it was the first demonstration I'd ever been to. And I had no expectations about it. And I look forward to hearing Martin Luther King, but it was basically because I had known he was a great orator. To tell you the truth, I don't think I would have believed that we would still be talking about that speech 50 years later.
Did you know, though, even though you went without those great expectations necessarily, did you know in the moment that something extraordinary was happening?
I knew that an extraordinary event was happening. I don't think I knew that the speech was going to be, because remember, for those of us who were there, it was the last speech in a long day of speeches.
Yeah.
So for me, I was thinking about how am I going to get out of this crowd? How am I going to get home? Lots of different things. So I think it was only over the course of years after that I really came to appreciate the historic importance of that speech.
Dorothy Cotton, you typed the last official version of that speech the night before. Tell us that story.
Yes, I did. We were, and some other staff members of SCLC, most of us were there. And I remember my room was on an upper floor, and my husband had come to town from Virginia where he was living, and we had both been living at some point. And I remember simply feeling very exhausted as George Cotton and I finally were making our way so we could stand close to the podium, and suddenly feeling very, very tired because I had done some typing the night before on some notes on the speech. And so actually listened to a part of it as I was walking back to the hotel, actually, as the speech was beginning. And I just remember being very tired, but I'm also very conscious of a lot of activity that was going on in the SCLC. All of us were excited about, first of all, just creating such an event, being there, getting there. And it was both very exhilarating to be a part of it, very exciting to be a part of it.
And there was, and I want to hear more about all that went into the creation of that event and some of the politics of what went on to create that event. But Clarence Jones, you were involved in the writing of the draft of that now famous speech. And of course, one of the most intriguing parts of this story is that the part, a little bit of which we heard in the introduction, the part that is most famous, the I Have a Dream part, was actually not part of the written text.
Yes. The most misunderstood fact about the celebrated I Have a Dream speech is that most people don't know that part of the speech, which is celebrated, was not written in the text. It was spontaneous. It was extemporaneous. And it only came about as a result of Dr. King reading from the opening text of his speech. And Mahalia Jackson, his favorite gospel singer, was on the platform. She had performed earlier. And she interrupted him. She shouted to him, "Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." I was standing some 50 feet behind Dr. King, and I saw him move the prepared text over to the left side of the lectern. And I said to somebody standing next to me, I said, "These people don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church." And I said that because I saw his kind of body movement change. And, when I was recounting this event, when I was discounting, as I've just described to you, to my publisher, when I was doing, the publisher says, "Well, you don't have any backup for this. We can't find any independent verification of what you're saying." And it was difficult until a friend of mine was listening to an audio book of Ted Kennedy. And she called me up very excitedly one day. She said, "You got to get the audiobook of Ted Kennedy. He talks about that event with Mahalia Jackson verbatim." Mm. So I got the book. And if you read Ted Kennedy's book, Compass, he describes it exactly verbatim as I describe it.
Fascinating. How is it possible, as someone you've spent most of your professional life, Claiborne Carson, reading and studying his writings, how is it even possible to do that, to improvise with that degree of eloquence? It seems beyond capability.
Well, in a way, he had been practicing that speech all of his life because he had been giving this speech called The American Dream and since the 1950s. And then in the 1960s, as Dorothy well knows, he began to say, "I have a dream," rather than "the American dream." Mm-hmm. And then he gave this wonderful speech at a mass rally in Detroit just a few months before.
June 23rd.
Right. It was almost like a rehearsal for the I Have a Dream speech because he uses that phrase.
Dorothy Cotton.
One thing I'm conscious of is that once we were really concerned about Dr. King being really just overly tired And some of us on the staff who kind of hung out with him every day, we said, well, you ought to have a speechwriter, somebody to help you. And we actually hired someone and asked to help him with creating a text of a speech. And we did indeed hire a young man. And I just want to share with you a term that I think that Martin created it himself. He said, well, yeah, he gave me a draft of a speech, but I have to kingize it. Now, I don't think anybody's ever heard that speech, but it's very clear to me that he said sort of almost a well, you know, with a smile on his face, it just wasn't his spirit, captured in what this, I say in quotes, a speechwriter who was going to help him. And we suggested he get the speechwriter because we felt his tiredness.
Yeah. Yeah, Clarence Jones, chime in on that, if you would, about king eyes factor as someone who drafted the early portion of the speech.
There's a lot of misinformation. You see, I don't doubt the accuracy of what Dorothy Carton is saying. I'm not suggesting that. But the fact of the matter is, it's not as if Dr. King came to Washington and he sat down and he said, now, what am I going to say? In fact, he did have to, what am I going to write? How am I going to put it together? But he had considerable in-depth discussion a couple of weeks, 3 or 4 weeks before, about what he might say at the March on Washington. And he was getting a lot of advice from different people. And then he stayed in my home in Riverdale, New York, the entire month of July. And during that, it was intended that he stay there to get some rest, because traditionally, particularly after the exhausting campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, he wanted to go away with his family and rest. People said, no, you can't go away. We're planning about this march. We have to have access to you. Anyway, to cut to the quick is that he had discussed extensively with Sandy Stanley Levison and myself. It also had some discussions, I know, with Baird Rustin and other people. And there were and then, of course, the night before in the lobby of the hotel, is that while he was upstairs in his suite working or, you know, with the Coretta, he came down to the lobby briefly. And there were people who were wanting to give him some advice. And I remember specifically Ralph saying, these people are coming to hear you preach. They were coming here to you preach tomorrow. Hmm. And then Professor Lewis Reddick saying, no, Martin, you've got to give a kind of erudite view of the movement. But he was very deferential, and obviously he wanted to indicate to people around him that he was accepting of his views. But in fact, I'm sure that he had in his mind a real concept of what he was going to say, and the only limited role that I provided was that I simply summarized. I simply wrote a summary of what he himself had said before. And so it's not as if I was creating something new. I was creating a draft of a summary of all of the thoughts and ideas that he himself had expressed, and I just put it in a written form that he might consider using. I had no idea, in fact, that he would use it until I heard it.
Let's hear again now an excerpt. This is the conclusion of that famous speech, and then I want to talk more about its significance and what he was trying to accomplish, because at that very time, of course, Congress was deliberating a civil rights legislation. So let's hear the conclusion of the speech.
And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Dorothy Cotton, I think you wanted to sing along with that.
Oh, not so much singing. I'm just really conscious of what a poet he was.
Yeah.
His use of language is just so impressive.
And what about that, Claiborne Carson, that the use of that poetic, rhythmic language, as opposed to sort of giving a speech about why it would be important to pass civil rights legislation?
Well, I think that's the relationship between the first part of the speech, which was the message. The message basically was... in the first paragraph where he talks about the architects of the Republic and the promissory note of the basically what he's arguing is that this nation was founded on the basis
of the
Declaration of Independence,
right.
and that promise. And so the march was an attempt to redeem that promise. But once he gets past that point, then the question becomes, well, what happens to the nation if we do achieve this? And I think he wanted to lay out a vision for what kind of a nation we might have in a future America where that promise has been realized.
And Clarence Jones, there was also a debate, was there not, about even where the speech would take place and President Kennedy's concern in particular about whether or not the demonstration and the speech would wind up being counterproductive to getting civil rights legislation passed?
Yes. This arose that there was a meeting of at the White House, I think, on June 22nd. At the meeting, there was a question about the wisdom of having the march, which was initially planned, the venue of the march was initially planned to be in Capitol Hill, at the streets outside of Congress, right at the foot of Congress. And the president and the Justice Department felt that if the march were held there, particularly when he was just submitting a civil rights bill that was pending in Congress, that to paraphrase the president, is that Congress would think that they were negotiating with a gun to its head. And so he made a very powerful argument, and ultimately persuasive, that the target, that the venue of the march should not be where it was originally planned, but it should be moved someplace else. And so it was moved to the foot of the Lincoln Memorial. And there was, same meeting, there was an effort to indirectly try to get Dr. King to reconsider, not just Dr. King, but other leaders, particularly A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and so forth, to reconsider moving the march, and even implying that maybe it's not a good thing. And Martin and other people were very persuasive, and finally the president came around, and history confirms that not only was the march peaceful in terms of the Justice Department's concern, it was overwhelmingly peaceful, and the reaction of the president afterwards, of course, this is after the fact, was one of great compliments to Dr. King particularly. I wasn't there, but when they had a meeting in the Oval Office, I'm told, when Dr. King and others first walked into the Oval Office, the president said, "And I have a dream." Hmm. He was very complimentary to the president, and also, I guess, somewhat relieved that the march had gone off so peacefully.
Where, Claiborne Carson, would you place this moment, this speech, in the arc of that time? It is so what we remember of his oratory and his work. Is it the single most important contribution, or has it overshadowed?
I think it symbolizes so much more. I mean, it symbolizes the crucial victory in the struggle for civil rights legislation was the victory in Birmingham. I mean, if you think about it, if King had failed in Birmingham, there wouldn't be an I Have a Dream speech. there might not have even been a march, or it would have been a very different kind of a march, maybe an angrier march if they had failed in Birmingham. But in any case, this represented that culmination of a mass struggle that had grown from just, Rosa Parks and a few people in the mid-50s to a movement of millions of people by 1963 in the summer of 63. So I think it symbolizes that entire process. And, of course, in some ways it was, as King himself said, it was not an end but a beginning. It was a beginning of another phase of the movement that took King to the end of his life. And
Dorothy Cotton.
Your question also reminds me of something I find I'm focusing on a great deal these days. Another, I think, very, very important line, well, there were just so many of them and thoughts that he put forth. One is, we will either learn to live together on this planet as brothers and sisters, or we will perish together as fools. I'm really looking at that and working with that and thinking about that now, especially as violence seems to be proliferating, like, all over the place. And I even scribbled some notes recently, and I said, yes, that is so true, because we're not learning to live together on the planet. We are, the hatred and the violence is, I guess the word is proliferating. And we need to look at that. What does it mean to learn to live together on the planet? We can no longer deny that we are part of a global community. Maybe some people would not want to use that word, but we are moving forward. And I think we need to keep that vision in front of us today. And your question reminded me of that quote. We will either learn to live together on the planet, because we're not moving in that direction right now.
We have to go to a break in just a few moments, but let's raise that question. And Clarence Jones, just start us out briefly, if you would, on that, about where you place us now, 50 years after that speech, in terms of progress made, in terms of dream achieved versus dream deferred?
Well, as Dorothy Cotton so referenced, eloquently, in her own words and also paraphrasing Dr. King's words, I put it slightly differently, but not necessarily better than Dorothy has stated, but just to remind everybody today in 2013 in March in the United States of America that we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of what I call the Apostle of Nonviolence. And it is clear, it becomes clear every day, 24/7, that America and the world, but particularly in our own country, that we have a simple choice. We either have to commit ourselves to nonviolence, or we're going to be involved in a life of continued violence. This is either nonviolence or non-existence, or nonviolence or co-annihilation,
yeah,
as Dr. King said in his acceptance speech of the Nobel Peace Prize.
And Claiborne Carson, on that point, he stayed true to that. If you read his last writings, that commitment to nonviolence never, ever wavered.
Not at all. But it was a deeper commitment than what most people mean by nonviolence is simply the lack of violence.
Yeah.
What he meant is something deeper than that. It was a commitment to social justice. And I think that in many ways he was misunderstood as simply a civil rights leader.
And he wrote about love and what that meant as being not just nonviolence.
Yeah, I think his notion of love was the political and social representation of or the other way around, love, the political expression of it, is justice. Because if you care for other people, you want to do justice for them. And I think that notion is I think he's put in this box of simply saying, don't use violence. But he wanted to use nonviolence for a specific purpose.
We will come back and talk more about those concepts, what they mean today, where we need to still travel when we return. We welcome your thoughts and comments, too. What do you remember about that time in 1963? What are your thoughts and memories, both of the movement and where you would like to see that movement head today? You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. More with Claiborne Carson, Dorothy Cotton, and Clarence Jones in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. 50 years ago this summer, Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. As we've already heard in the first part of our program, those most famous words were improvised from the written text. We're joined this hour by three people who were there that day and who knew Martin Luther King well. Claiborne Carson, the director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute at Stanford University. His latest book is Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Dorothy Cotton is here too, civil rights leader and former education director at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Her book is If Your Back's Not Bent, The Role of the Citizen Education Program in the Civil Rights Movement, and Clarence Jones, also at Stanford, and the co-author of Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed a Nation. If we fast forward to the present and think about where we are now, I'm curious about how you view the moment when President Obama took the oath for his second term and used the Bible of Martin Luther King. Symbolic moment, to be sure, but did it tell us where we were with the dream today? Dorothy Cotton.
Well, I make probably several observations. And let me say that another way. I've evolved to a place where I'm asking, I think, some new and different questions relative to the idea, the concept of having a dream. Because I think I find as I move around the country on college campuses, other schools and groups, conferences, whatever, it's almost like people are waiting for Dr. King to come back and bring his dream into reality. And I'm sensing that people almost absolve themselves of any responsibility to have a dream for themselves for today. That they simply look, you know, at Dr. King with taking no responsibility for working towards solving the problems that we face today. And that concerns me. I was at one situation where a little girl who was maybe 6 years old, you're very cutely dressed with her bows and little and, you know, fluffy dresses and all, and she could say, I have a dream. But I wondered, are they teaching this little girl what Dr. King meant when he said that? But even more, what is her dream? And then to talk about what her or our or anyone's, what our having a dream, how that is important. Why that is important, that we also have a vision of looking at, focusing on what can we bring to the situation today. We meaning all the citizens of the world, if you will.
And it's something President Obama has talked about as far as people taking individual responsibility for their own dreams. But tell me your thoughts on where we stand with that and the significance of any of taking that oath on Dr. King's Bible. Clarence.
Yes, I just wanted to say that in addition to being a scholar and writer in residence working proudly with Dr. Carson at Stanford, I'm also a visiting professor at University of San Francisco. And I'm particularly pleased that among the various places, not the only place, I guess, but certainly the University of San Francisco, in response to the 50th anniversary of the Dream, is contemplating the a Center for the Prevention of Violence and Conflict Resolution, which is specifically intended to recognize that violence is a existential threat to all of us. But let me be more direct in terms of what I think where we are today. Is that Dorothy alluded to it earlier. You'd have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to know that it's almost like an epidemic that swept our country with violence. And, you know, in 1963, I think I agree with the suggestions Dr. Carson said. It is unlikely that the march would have ever occurred but for Birmingham. But what happened in Birmingham? In Birmingham, where more than 2,500 or 3,000 people were incarcerated, mostly young people, and the nation saw pictures across the nation on television and newspapers and of black and white girls and boys being slammed against the wall with pressure fire hoses and bitten by police dogs, And this ultimately raises a question of what kind of nation are we? What kind of a nation will permit and abide this to take place? And after Newtown, Connecticut, that's what's happening again. What kind of nation are we that will abide having our young children? As one of the parents painfully said, they are killing our babies. So I really believe that the number one thing that comes from the number one issue that arises as we reflect on the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech is the essence of Dr. King was a commitment to nonviolence. And by the way, he somewhat resented being called a civil rights leader constantly. He wanted to remind people, look, I am a minister of the gospel. And as a minister of the gospel, I do not segregate my moral concerns. And the love that we were talking about is based on his deep abiding belief in the scriptures of his Lord Jesus Christ. You have to love thy enemy.
Well, let's take that point then and Clifford Carson expand upon that on where you place President Obama within this larger context, and perhaps particularly on this issue now of confronting violence.
Well, I would put it in a larger historical as a historian, maybe I would do this in the sense that I think that King was speaking to Jefferson through Lincoln. President Obama often in his speeches refers back to King, Lincoln, Jefferson, and all of them are talking about one particular issue. Jefferson laid out this notion of a democratic society. All men are created equal. And we're involved in a test of that. And we have been throughout our history. The Civil War was a test of that. The civil rights struggle was a test of that. We're still in a test. And when King said this is not an end but a beginning, I think what he meant was we're at the beginning of an experiment of whether you can have a multicultural, multiracial democracy. So we're in the first half century of that experiment. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. And I think what Clarence and what Dorothy are bringing, there's no guarantee that it's going to turn out well. The best guarantee we have is the message of nonviolence.
He wrote in one of his last speeches, Where Do We Go From Here? Just let me read a few phrases that still ring so current. He writes, we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising the question about the economic system, about the broader distribution of wealth. And then he goes on to say, let us be dissatisfied until those that live on the outskirts of hope are brought into the metropolis of daily security. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows. Let us be dissatisfied. So all of those questions could be said now, not just 50 years ago.
Yeah, the issue that you just raised, the issue of poverty, became more central to his focus after the March on Washington, as Dorothy knows especially. That the whole focus of the Poor People's Campaign was to get the country focused on this question of poverty.
Yes.
In fact, there are some of us, and I just speak for myself, but I know that there are other people who share my point of view, who believe that, when Dr. King began to focus on what we call the jugular vein of this system, economic power, that's when he became more of a pariah. See, we sit here, we're talking on the phone about celebrating the 50th year of the I Have a Dream speech. The fact of the matter is, when he was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, he had become pretty much of a pariah to much in this country, particularly the power structures. In terms of the traditional way of polling, I suppose on August 28th, 1963, the time of his speech, maybe he had an approval rating of 80%, but at the time of his assassination, it was much less. And that's because he began to focus on the question of poverty and the responsibility that the powerful and the wealthy and the government have to do something about it.
Let me hold you there, if I might, Clarence Jones, and take a few calls, people who want to raise questions about our topic this morning. We're joined by Mahasan, who joins us from Oakland. Go ahead with your question, please.
Good morning. I'm so honored to be in the presence of the historical figures sitting there with you and thanking them and thanking God for their contributions, and we can keep this dream alive. I had a couple of questions and one statement. It's amazing to me. I grew up and came of age in the 60s and 63 when all these major events, life-changing and history-shaping events took place, and they had a similar impact on me. At a time when you're a teenager, you're looking for the meaning in your life. You're looking for your destination. Where will I go? What will I do with all these values? It was critical, and I feel eternally blessed to have been under the influence that Dr. King's mission brought in all of the dedicated people that work with him. But my question is, and my statement is that I have seen more bloodless violence coming toward the time that we're living in now from the enemies of what I call social justice. And I'd like for you to talk a little bit about what that justice was that Dr. King saw and was so dedicated to. We have the sequestration going on now. We visit on a regular basis, the bickering about the debt ceiling. We had the whole foreclosure debacle and the loss of people's pensions and the criminal Wall Street behavior.
Okay, Mahasan, thank you. Thanks for raising that question. How would, do you think, Dr. King respond to those very pragmatic things that Mahasan raises about, in terms of how they would define our concept of justice?
Well, I think it's important just to keep that image of what King was doing at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in Memphis helping those at the bottom of the social structure mm-hmm. to win a labor movement, to get a better life.
And the sanitation
workers in Memphis. And, you know, that to me is how, in addition to that image of him giving that speech in Washington, we should always keep that image of what was he doing at the end of his life and what would he be doing now when conditions for so many people are just as dire. And I think that part of what I see that we need to focus on the least of these, the people who are not benefiting from our society and who do not have a great deal of hope for the future. And that's really the future of democracy, because what American democracy really means is opportunity. That if this is a land of opportunity, we'll survive as a society. The moment it stops being that, I think then we put the entire experiment in doubt.
Dorothy Cotton.
Well, I'm really interested in thinking a lot about how we can help, infuse the culture, the education systems, wherever, with a deeper, broader understanding of what nonviolence means, to live that way, to live from that perspective, to work from that perspective. For example, I've been in situations recently where people ask a question from the audience of me, and they end it. I couldn't just stand there and let somebody hit me on one cheek from the turn the other cheek, which I think is a Bible quotation from the Sermon on the Mount, I think. But their concept of one's interpretation, who would ask that question, is about physically, literally standing there letting somebody hit one on the cheek or not, rather than understanding in the most depthful, in the broadest possible sense of caring for one's neighbor and having a vision of what kind of world we could work towards, and that we ourselves would work towards it, not waiting for some expert to come and tell us how to do it.
So nonviolence not as something that's passive, but something that's assertively arguing for and pushing for certain goals.
Absolutely. I think that's what we should need to start teaching, because there's a lot of very deep misinterpretation of what it means. It's so limiting, and we haven't done a good job of putting forth the notion and the concept of nonviolence and, broadly how it looks at the whole.
Christine writes on our web page, I would invite the conversation to be more explicit about how our nation is being torn asunder by the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. I would invite the panel to be explicit that in order to practice nonviolence, we must remove the instruments of violence, very much along the lines of what you're arguing, Clarence Jones.
Yeah, I would say I don't want to be unduly repetitious, but the fact of the matter is, we talk about what's the most important phrase in the March on Washington? The first word, march. Mm-hmm. I think that Dr. King today, he would look. I mean, he would assess the situation and say, "My God, we're sitting here when there's incontrovertible evidence of the poverty, incontrovertible evidence of the violence." And we don't need any more conferences. We don't need any more studies. We don't need any think tanks. We don't need any of those things. We just need people who are sufficiently aroused, and he would mm-hmm. particularly address this to the faith-based mm-hmm. community and the labor movement, but it's much less powerful than it was then, but particularly the faith-based community. Where are all of the leaders, of the various community leaders, the various top religious leaders? Why aren't they saying... Yeah. Enough's enough. Well, aren't they recognizing that we are at a crisis moment?
This is right. Why, yeah, I say we must teach. We must teach. We must teach. People don't understand nonviolence.
And even in his day, did he not, Dr. Carson, have concerns about the religious leaders stepping forward? And he also had concerns about white moderates being too concerned
yes,
with
absolutely.
Maintaining order. Mm-hmm. I mean, those were concerns he had even then, let alone would now.
Yeah, well, looking back, it's amazing how much he was willing to push the notion of nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had recent experience with the Occupy movement.
Right.
Well, Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign was an Occupy movement.
That's correct.
It was let's go to the mm-hmm. Washington Mall.
We forget that.
And occupy that until Congress acts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of boldness we don't see in any of the leaders today.
Let me ask.
And I think that is pushing the limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe at this stage in history, we need to push the limits of nonviolence.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about how he sustained hope. I'm going to this speech that was given toward the end of his life, Where Do We Go From Here? And he writes, there will be moments when the buoyancy of hope will be transformed into the fatigue of despair. But difficult and painful as it is, we must walk on in the days ahead with an audacious faith in the future. Did he never doubt the future?
I think he never doubted. Somewhere he said, if I am the last lone voice, I remember his using that phrase. I wish I could pinpoint at this moment where it was. If I am the last lone voice speaking out for nonviolence in its broadest interpretation and concept, I will be that voice.
Mm-hmm.
I heard him say that so strongly. And I also saw pain in his eyes, even tears in his eyes once, when he was criticized. As a matter of fact, it was Mr. Hoover was who called him ugly name, and that was painful to him because he was so committed to what he was doing. But I also want to, before we end this dialogue, also bring forth the fact that he also had a joy for living and doing the work that he did. And when I say joy for living, I mean even a sense of humor. And which I think I want to put him forth as a whole human being. There were moments when he could be sad, but not often. And even teary-eyed that time when J. Edgar Hoover called him a notorious liar. That was it. But when he goes forward, smiling, laughing with us. I have a photograph in my book of him singing, leading a group, singing and playing badminton with folk in my workshop that I was doing for his organization. But also he was so committed to what his life, what he'd given his life to.
But I wonder if that isn't an important part of what we ought remember about him in this anniversary year, because it seems like we get discouraged pretty readily. And if he sustained hope, that's something that's important to remember, too. Clarence Jones?
Yeah, I mean, he's a human being. He was He was yes, he did get despondent, and it was his abiding belief in his in his Lord Jesus Christ, to paraphrase his words, or the he would say, I heard him say on more than one occasion, referring to that phrase of Reverend James Cleveland. So nobody told us the road would be easy, but
right.
Lord, I don't believe you brought me this far just to leave
right.
me. He had an abiding belief.
Mm-hmm.
It, he couldn't. His
mm-hmm.
despondency was only able to be dealt with, not from the traditional psychiatric terms, but because of his profound belief in God. And there were times when he was really, really despondent. He was the subject of unremitting political attacks. Orchestrated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, unremitting attacks.
A web comment that perhaps you can answer, Dr. Carson. Vihar writes, we've talked some about the influence of the gospel and his faith, but Vihar asks, could one of your guests comment on how much influence, speaking of nonviolence, Gandhi had on Dr. King?
Oh, of course, a great deal.
Yes.
I think that I would see him as a Gandhian.
Yes.
He understood that what Gandhi had done was something that was very important in the history of nonviolence. And,
yes.
and I think it has to do with some of the comments today. We sometimes associate that with the history of pacifism, which was mainly a middle class, more elite movement of opposition to war. I think what Gandhi was able to do was to take that and turn it into a political force.
And didn't he write, Clarence Jones, in the letter to Birmingham, which you helped smuggle out of that jail, that he wanted to provoke a crisis?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this was an assertive, aggressive nonviolence.
You know, there's no unanimity among King followers or scholars, but I happen to believe, with all due respect to many things that he's written or spoken, I believe that the letter from the Birmingham jail still remains as perhaps a seminal document, together with the speech that he is his public opposition to the war in Vietnam, because in those documents, in the speech he gave on April 4th, 1967, the first public opposition to the war in Vietnam, is that he really linked the issue of violence, nonviolence, and the whole question of the poverty, because in effect he was saying Lyndon Johnson was squandering the resources of the Treasury in pursuing this violent war in Vietnam, which was depriving the government of the resources to deal with the poor. And of course, in the letter from the Birmingham jail, it is a classic. It is a classic reflection of the philosophy of nonviolence, and it's a classic reflection of his American application of his profound belief in Gandhi and his profound belief in that you have to love the people you serve.
Dorothy Cotton.
I think this speaks to a question you raised a minute ago. We were sprawled around in someone's living room. I think we were in Selma, Alabama. Anyway, we were under an injunction not to march, for example. And another one of our lawyers, Chauncey Eskridge, was sitting around in the room. We were like on the floor, around all the chairs, whatever. Just the room was full of folk. And I remember that Clarence, he said... Chauncey Eskridge said, Dr. King, if you all march, don't you know that you're under an injunction not to march? And if you march, you're going to get in trouble. And I can hear Dr. King's voice. Now, what he said was, Chauncey, it is our place to get in trouble, and it is your place to get us out of trouble.
Great.
Very well, that's great.
You know about that, Clarence.
Let me just read one line, and then we're going to hear one more excerpt from Dr. King from the letter from the Birmingham jail, in which he writes, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects us all." From the letter from a Birmingham jail. We're going to play one last bit of audio. This is from his last speech from the moment that we were describing before in Memphis the night before he died. This is the "I've Been to the Mountaintop" speech. We'll just listen to a brief excerpt.
Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Martin Luther King, April the 3rd, 1968. Just a moment left. Each of you, what would you like us to think about on this 50th anniversary year of the I Have a Dream speech? Dorothy Cotton.
I would like us to think about whether we have infused either the dream, the way Dr. King spoke of having a dream, but that each one of us on the planet now develop, create our own dream to carry that his forward if we are stirred by that. But what is our dream to every citizen of the world today? Now, what kind of world do we want to live in? And can we ourselves work to bring our dream into reality?
And just briefly, Clarence Jones.
I would simply say that to remember that as extraordinary a person as he was and will live in history, is that our responsibility, the responsibility of those who are living, is to take that dream and to try to implement it 24/7 as much as possible. And we cannot do that unless we face the reality of existential violence in our country today.
And Dr. Carson?
I think to follow up on what Clarence has just said, I think to think of our country as this experiment, the first, one of the first experiments in multiracial, multicultural democracy. Mm-hmm. And then just think, what is our responsibility to make sure that that works? Understanding that if it doesn't work, it's going to be a cataclysmic result for everyone. So I think that that's where we have to look to King for guidance in terms of how to make that work.
I want to thank you all for being part of our conversation, Claiborne Carson, Dorothy Cotton, Clarence Jones. We'll close by listening to a little bit of Mahalia Jackson. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.